Welcome to Career Tools. How to get your email read. Here we go. This cast answers these questions. How do I increase the chance my email will be read? How do I increase the chances I'll get replies to my email? How do I get the answers I need via email? If you want the answers to these and more, keep listening.
If your knowledge of desk, high D's, I's, S's, and C's, the perfectionists, the Attila the Huns, the marketers, the team players, if that has helped you become more effective at work, you'll want to seriously consider coming to our Effective Communications Conference. We set the basics of DISC in an hour or so, and then we spend the rest of the day teaching you how finally to communicate effectively, which is to pay attention to what your listener does and communicate in a way that makes sense to them. At the end of the day, you'll be able to read someone in a conversation, determine their major DISC tendency, and then based on that, make some changes in how you deliver to improve the chances that you get harmony and congruence and collaboration and not drama, conflict, and tension. Come see us.
Wendy, as most people probably listening know, email is one of those.
Is there anyone listening who hasn't had email, who hasn't used email?
I doubt it, seriously. But email is one of those mediums that almost guarantees that some of your questions won't get answered, right? You send the email, and then you're pretty sure that arrives, right? The internet seems to work pretty well when it comes to delivery of mail, and you have no assurance that it'll be read or answered. If you were having a conversation, you'd be standing there waiting for the other person to answer, right? And you get some visual cues as to what's going on. But with email, there's no pressure on them. A lot of folks, let's put it that way, don't feel any obligation necessary to return your email. So there's a way to resolve that. And the answer is, I assume, not to turn up the pressure, as if you can, right?
Not to be one of those people that sends an email and 5 minutes later is standing at your desk going, have you seen my email? Like, that's not the way to go about it.
I think we've shared on the Manager Tools cast one of the stories where our manager sent an email to a person. There's some production support issue in this IT organization. Had sent the manager, I had sent the person working it an email. And literally, it was no more than 1 minute later, showed up at the person's desk asking them what kind of progress they'd made on the issue.
You might as well have just walked there in the first place.
It was crazy. This particular manager did not have great relationships with their people, but they improved greatly after doing some of the things we suggested. But anyway, that's a topic for another day. So tell me about emails and how we're gonna get better responses from folks without, as you said, like showing up their desk and turning up a bunch of pressure.
Okay, so all we're going to do is change the way we think of and write our emails. So all of the actions lie with you. They don't have to lie with someone else. So you don't have to depend on someone else. You can make some changes, which mean that it's more likely that your email will get read and answered. So first of all, we're going to use better subject lines. We're going to use bluff, which is bottom line up front. We're not going to have scroll bars, but with an asterisk. We'll come to that later. And only use attachments when really necessary.
Well, using better subject lines. I love that. I mean, one of my pet peeves is, well, there's two of them, actually, when it comes to email. One of them is when I'm scanning my inbox, not being clear what is being discussed or what is being asked of me in the subject line, like having no clue what's going on. The second, even bigger pet peeve, which I'm sure we're not going to talk about, is when a conversation morphs into a different conversation than the original email, yet the still has the same original email subject, which is completely unrelated to what's being discussed at the time. Those two things drive me absolutely nuts. So tell me how you're going to correct that so that nobody listening today is ever going to do that again.
It's always the emails that are completely vague about what they want you to do that sit around on your desk and you think, oh, I'll get to that, or I need 30 minutes to think about that, and then the 30 minutes never comes. So all of the guidance we're going to have is about making your emails easier for the person who's receiving them to read and respond to. And of course, that starts with the subject line. So the first very easy way to change your subject lines is to include a verb. And so a verb is described by English teachers everywhere, I'm sure, as a doing word. And so the verb tells the person that receives the email what you want them to do. So I've got some examples. So a lot of people send emails that say problem X. And so the subject is about this problem, But you don't know what they want you to do about the problem. Like, you have to go into the email and actually read it, where, as opposed to being able to scan it. So perhaps you might write, please review and approve this approach to problem X, which is much clearer, right? Just review it and approve it, right?
Right. Versus solve it for me, right?
Which, yeah, exactly.
And if I concluded that's what it was about, I'd probably delay opening it, because I'm thinking in my head, I got an hour and a half worth of work here to process this email. But to review an approach and to approve it is a different story entirely.
That's true. I hadn't thought of it that way, but that actually makes it a huge difference. So next one, another common thing, customer why. So people will just put the customer name in the email. And again, you know it's about that customer, but you don't know what you're supposed to do or what aspect it is, or whether it's a lot of work or a little work. So perhaps you might write, please make recommendations on the retention of customer why. So now it's like a 20-minute job, right? And you know that, and you can schedule it into your day. And so if your recipient is doing that, again, you're more likely to get it answered. So the last one I had was employee Z, or employee Z, I guess, which is another thing. You know, somebody might just write someone's name in the subject line. And if it's somebody who's been a problem, that makes you even less likely to answer the email or even to open it. But if we write, please share your observations about employee Z in situation A, it's narrower. So you know what the scope is before you open the email, and you know what you have to do.
What do you think about adding a deadline to that? Now, I can imagine, let me get the first one out of the way. The first thing that went through my head as I asked myself that question was, I probably wouldn't give my boss a deadline. So if I'm writing to my boss and I want him to review a particular approach, I may not say, you know, please review and provide approval by 4 o'clock on Friday. I probably wouldn't do that. That may not come across all that great. But so let's just put aside bosses for a minute. What do you think about putting dates on there to further help people understand the criticality of it, or to help them prioritize or whatever?
Definitely, if you're a manager to your directs, you know, absolutely you can do that. And probably you should be, because that will help them learn how to prioritize things and help them to understand the priority or the urgency. If you're doing it for peers, it depends on your relationship and it depends what the question is, right? So, for example, when I used to work with procurement, and there were contracts that had deadlines, like we had to have it signed by a certain day in order to make sure that the contractor was on site the following Monday. And so then I might put it in there, like, need signature by whatever date, because there was an understanding that I was asking for that date in order so that I could get something else. And that if we missed that date, I wouldn't get what I wanted, but it was probably still okay. So I wasn't demanding that they do it by that date, but it was a kind of a heads up for, this is how urgent this is in my world.
Right. And if there is a date associated with something that something needs to get done by, because maybe it's driven externally, right? You have to get a client proposal to somebody by the 15th of May, for example. It'd be useful to know that up front, even if you're sending something to your boss, right?
Mm-hmm. And the other thing, I have sent them to my boss. I have sent things to Mark with deadlines on them, where something would or would not be able to happen after the deadline. So, for example, if I was going to cancel some flights, you have to be within 24 hours. And so if I knew he was presenting, for example, and he was going to look at his email the list very quickly during breaks, I might write, need a decision on cancelling X after 4 p.m. will incur a charge. So at least he knows the consequences of not making that decision. I'm not telling him he has to make a decision. I'm saying there's consequences if you don't. And then he can make that decision.
So I guess the other thing here is that when we're looking for a verb, you describe, you know, using verbs. And I think you're talking about what I call action verbs, right?
Mm-hmm.
What action do you want people to take?
Yeah, so like approve, decide. I can't think of any more. I need a list. Okay, so
approve,
whenever I
decide,
get stuck.
Complete,
uh-huh.
Send, right? Things like,
yeah,
directive.
Things like that. And if you get stuck, like I do really quickly, there are hundreds of lists on websites. If you look up action verbs, they're designed for people to help people write their resumes, to begin the, because you begin the accomplishment line with a verb of what you did, so achieved or completed. And so there's these lists which are designed for people that are trying to do their resumes, but will be equally useful if you're trying to find a verb for the beginning of your email subject.
That's a good recommendation. I'm going to push back on you a little bit here in terms of your subject lines here, because I should have done this prior to us doing it on a podcast, but what the heck? Why not just get on your right in front of the entire world here? So, you know, the subject line is only so long, right? You only have so many, so many words. And you wasted like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, like six letters with please. I mean, is it really important just to be nice? I mean, you're a nice person, but come on, really? Do we have to waste entire six letters there? And the space that goes after it. So it's really seven spaces.
Well, you could replace it with FYA, which is for your action. Then you'd still have to read the verbs to find out what that action is. So the idea of please is it gives the person an idea that you're about to make a request of them. You're going to ask them to do something. And if you start with please, everybody, manners are a good thing. You know, everybody does things more willingly if you ask and say please. If you're really anti-please, then you could use FYA for your action.
Yeah, I am kind of making fun of you, frankly, because I would prefer to put please in there. And not since I'm such a nice guy, because, you know, I'm really not. I find that I get better results that way. If I say please, I am more likely to get that action from the individual for whom I've requested it. And if I don't, I get less of what I want. And so I say please. A little pleasantness in the workplace doesn't hurt, right? It can be rough and tumble every once in a while. Saying please, not going to kill us.
Manners are the grease. You're going to have a little grease between your ball bearings.
Yes, absolutely. That's what please is, right? That's what manners is. It's the grease or the oil that lubricates our relationships with people. And without manners, it becomes a pretty nasty, dirty place. So little manners good.
The other thing you can include in your subject lines to help people know what they're going to have to do is to tell them when they're not going to have to take an action. So most people know the acronym FYI for your information. There's also NAR, which is no action required. And depending on whether or not those are usual abbreviations in your organization, you can either write the whole thing out or you can use the abbreviation. But the benefit of that is that people will read your emails or they'll read down the subject lines and they'll think, oh, so Bob sent me 5 emails today, but 3 of them I only have to read and 2 of them I have to action. And they'll feel so much better about their inbox and about your emails, because you're not just sending them in a way that's kind of higgledy-piggledy or without any sense. They are able to take more efficient action when they know what to expect. And if you don't ask for action every time, even when you don't need action, or if you imply that you need action when you don't need it, it's a bit like the boy who cries wolf. When you really need it, your subject line won't stand out.
Yeah, good point. And I think people appreciate that kind of information, emails, because it helps me prioritize my inbox as I go through them. I think you didn't mention one acronym, which I absolutely love, which is the EOM, or end of message, which is simply the subject that is, in fact, the entire email. The best email ever, just a subject with EOM at the end of it. It's awesome.
Yeah. Well, there's also NMI, no message inside. There's a whole long list of abbreviations on Wikipedia of all sorts of things that are quite useful that you think, oh, great. There's one that is FYFG, which is for your future guidance. In other words, like things from HR that tell you how to do your expenses next month would be FYFG. But you have to be a little bit careful if you start using really idiosyncratic abbreviations, because not everybody will know them, and you'll spend more time answering questions about what your abbreviation meant than you will anything else.
Yeah, no, yeah. For me, don't include FYFG in an email because you're trying to make it easier on me. And in fact, it's not, because now I have to go to Wikipedia and look up the acronyms. But most organizations have a list, right? I mean, if you look at other emails within the organization, there is a somewhat informally, of course, agreed upon vocabulary for emails. And, you know, if you stick with that, you're in pretty good shape.
If you only do FYI, FYA, and EOM, you're 90% better than every other email they get.
And look, if you're the manager of your group, then by all means, you know, have a conversation with your team as to what kind of acronyms would be useful, or what kind of information in the subject emails would be useful to the team in terms of working through their email. And I've done that before, and it's been incredibly useful, and it's sometimes surprising. Somebody says, if you just included this, for example, in a particular organization, I had a number of IT organization had a number of applications, I don't know, probably like 100. And it was very useful for people to have the abbreviation of the application in the header of the email, particularly for production support, who's managing a whole bunch of this stuff. Is really useful for them to know upfront where they probably have to route something. So yeah, you ask your folks, they'll tell you.
Yeah, they probably have some ideas. Okay, so the second thing on our list is BLUF, which stands for bottom line upfront. And if you've listened to more than 10 Manager Tools podcasts, you've probably heard it more than once. And it means that the most important information needs to be in the first paragraph of the email. So we have an example. The subject line is, please review and approve this approach to problem X. And the first paragraph is, our customers are erroneously getting emails indicating the end of their subscription. We propose, and then there's a list of actions to be taken and who's going to take it. And then underneath that, there's a heading that says details and a bunch of detail about what's going wrong and what they know and how many people it's affecting and all those kind of things.
All the stuff that I don't want to read.
Exactly.
Just tell me what we need to do. Right. Now, some people want it, though, right? Some people want the details. And you as an individual may feel, if you're a high C in DISC parlance, you probably want to provide the details. You don't feel comfortable not providing the details. So that's fine. Just put it in a section that clearly indicates with the header as what's in there. And if you have a high D kind of just straight to the point manager or team member, they can get the bottom line up front stuff and skip all the details.
Yeah. And they can then reply. The best thing about this email is you can reply in two words, I approve. Or you could reply in one. You could just write approved. So right. All the high Ds are like, this is awesome, this email. And one word, I'm done. And it took me 20 seconds to read. If somebody needs to know all the technical details, they need to know, you know, if this is a 20-hour effort that the person has proposed, and then in the detail it says it only affects 6 customers out of 600,000, then you probably wouldn't approve it. And if the number of customers affected is relevant to you making the decision, then it'll be there in the details. And hopefully then you can use that piece of information to make the decision. The idea is to send someone all the information they need to take the action that you want them to take, but to organize it in such a way that they don't have to read more than they need in order to make the decision.
Right. Well, just think about the opposite, right, of bottom line up front, which is send somebody an email without a clear subject, just say customer X, for example, and then in the body of the email, have a story that's, say, 9 paragraphs long. And then in the last sentence of the 8th paragraph, if it's at the bottom, you'd just be making it way too easy on the reader. So in the last sentence of the 8th paragraph of 9 paragraphs, you have the actual question, the action that you need from the reader. I mean, seriously, you've now told me what you want me to do. Now that I have that context, I have to go back and read the entire email all over again so I can answer the question. Because I'm reading, it's like the never ending the dog story that never ends. You don't have any context as to what you're being asked, so you don't know what details to pay attention to or what not to. And in 9 paragraphs, there can be a lot of details. So I think you did the right order, like the subject, and man, bottom line up front has got to be right right behind that in terms of how to write effective emails.
If you had that person who wrote that 9-paragraph email with a question in the 8th paragraph, what would you do the next time you had an email from them? Like, you wouldn't open it because you'd think, oh my God, it's going to be as bad as the last one.
Yeah. And I have 400 emails to process today. And yeah, I don't need that long story. Really don't.
Yeah. So you compound the problem by not only sending one bad email, but then your recipients just assume that all the rest are going to be bad. And you get further and further down their queue, which is not what you want.
You know, it's also interesting because occasionally, it doesn't happen all the time, but you know, maybe 5% of the time, I'll get a bottom line up front question and a bunch of details at the bottom. Much of it, a summary of conversations that I've already been in and participated in. If I know what the question is up front, I often don't have to read the rest of the email and know the answer. Right. So instead of, you know, 5 minutes reading through all the details, I can send back approve, do it, don't do it, whatever, in, you know, in about 10 seconds.
And that's particularly true if you've got a bunch of people involved and then the email goes to even more people. So if it has to go to a different team and you're asking, someone is asking you as a manager and the manager of that team to take action. Well, the manager of that team needs a bunch of detail because they haven't been in any of the conversations and you don't. So the email is organized so that it works for both of you.
Yeah, good point. I love this topic because we get so much email. If we could just improve them by 5 or 10%, just imagine the savings. Okay, so go on. This is good stuff.
Okay, so the next one is don't have scroll bars with an asterisk. So we'll start with don't have scroll bars. And if you don't know what a scroll bar is, if you open an email and you start typing, you can type anything, type a bunch of returns, and you're looking at the right-hand edge of the email, eventually you'll notice that it changes. And there's a thing that makes you go up and down so you can see the top of the email and the bottom of the email. That's the scroll bar.
Right. So what you really mean when you say don't have scroll bars is don't make your emails long. Is that, I mean, that's the point. Make them short.
Make them short. Exactly. And the shorter an email is, the more likely it is to be read. It's just simple. People are busy and they only have a limited amount of time and they'd rather fit in 3 things that were a paragraph long than 1 thing that was 3 paragraphs long because the 3 things makes them feel more successful. And if it's long, people also think it'll take them a long time to reply. They assume that there's more information that they'll have to think about, they'll have to fit into context, all that kind of stuff. And so they leave the email for a time when they have time to reply, and that time never comes.
If it weren't a complex problem or issue or conversation, they certainly wouldn't spend 8 paragraphs doing it. If it were simple,
yeah,
it'd be short.
Yeah. That's what your recipients are thinking, so keep it short. And it depends on your email screen. It depends what screen you're using and what email client you're using, how many paragraphs it takes until you get a scroll bar. But if you have never paid attention to how long your emails are, that's a good starting point. And then if you want the advanced version, then no more than 3 paragraphs and no more than 5 sentences in each. And if you want to go really advanced, no more than 8 words in each sentence.
And 3 paragraphs and 5 sentences each seems like still seems pretty big. But I guess it's a good place to start for exactly. Many people.
Have you seen how many people can't write emails in 3 paragraphs?
I have indeed. Way too often.
Exactly. And we've included an asterisk because not all emails can be written in just a couple of paragraphs, especially if you need a lot of history or technical detail. But if you find yourself about to write an email that you know will go past 3, 4, 5 paragraphs, then consider whether or not email is the right way to be sharing that information. Would it not be better to have a phone call or a conversation? Or is there another way for the person to access that history without you retyping it all into an email? And then the other question is, does this person even need all this detail in order to make a decision? If you in a retail store and you want to change the price from $5.99 to $7.99. And the reason it's at $5.99 is because there was a promotion, but when the promotion was on, there was a different manager. And when the new manager came, they forgot to change it back. And it's been like that for 2 years and we're losing money. Like, does the manager need all that information in order to be able to approve, like, the price is $5.99, we lose money on it, I think we should change it to $7.99, do you approve? They didn't need all that history. And if they wanted it, they'd ask for it.
I think people also, when they write long emails, they fail to consider that the longer the email, the more they need to think about the structure of the email. Mm. If it's simply three paragraphs, the structure is often fairly self-evident. Once it gets much beyond that, then the wise email sender will have spent, and most people do not, a considerable amount of time thinking about how to structure the information. So there's a lot of intellectual energy being spent on the organization of the data once it gets beyond three to five paragraphs. And a hint for folks, I know this is kind of beyond the scope of this particular podcast, but there is an excellent book around the organization of written material called the Minto, M-I-N-T-O, the Minto Pyramid Principle by Barbara Minto. And if you write reports or you regularly share copious information, that is an excellent place to start. Barbara's a friend of mine, so I'm a little biased here, but it is widely considered one of the best books on writing professional reports and output. So check it out, the Minto Pyramid Principle. Now, just don't be surprised. It's not a cheap book. I think it's like $100. So it's not cheap, but worth every penny.
Yeah, there's another version that floats around that is not as expensive, but isn't the right thing. I remember last time I looked at it, getting confused.
Okay. Now, your next one, only use attachments when really necessary. What's wrong with an attachment? You mean spreadsheets, Word documents?
That's right. The thing that's wrong with attachments is everything, nearly everything.
Everything, okay.
For one thing, people use attachments because they're too lazy to distill the information into a form which is comprehensible and which allows someone to make a decision. That drives me mad. It's like you get an email and it says this, this, and this, and you need to make a decision. And oh, by the way, the data that you need is on this tab in row 37 and column R. So could you not have just copied that out and just given me the number and not the spreadsheet? If you're using an attachment as a way of conveying the information they need to make a decision, then try and think of another way to do that, which doesn't involve the spreadsheet or the Word document or whatever else it is. Try and work out more specifically what the person needs in order to do what you want them to do. The other reason I don't like attachments is because it's a nightmare for version control. I version all my documents if I know that they're going to, if I know that there's going to be iterations of them, I tend to write V1, V2, V3, mm-hmm. and so on. But then somebody will send me one back and it will say V4 and I'm already on V5. And now I don't know what changes they made and they probably didn't have track changes on. And I've got a version and they've got, and now I don't know which is which.
That can be maddening, that particular problem.
And there's so many ways of sharing documents now. I was thinking about this when I was writing it. And even when I first went to work, like 100 years ago, before email, we could share documents on a shared drive. So if we could do it like in 1903, when I first went to work, you can do it now without using attachments and sending it by email and having this version control issue.
That's right.
And then the other thing, if you know disk, is that only half the population will open the attachment. Only the S's and C's will open it. The S is because they want to, because you created it, and therefore they want to value your time and honor your time by opening what you created. And the C's because it's got detail, and like, who doesn't love a spreadsheet, right? So if you're sending things to D's and I's with attachments, they're not opening them. The information in there is the information they need to make a decision. They're not having the right information to make that decision. And some of them will just not make a decision because you can't go wrong if you don't make a decision. And if I don't have the information and it's not being spoon-fed to me, then I don't want to make a decision.
One of the challenges of spreadsheets is people often become lazy. I go back to the analogy of writing a 20 paragraph email, that there's a considerable amount of time spent on the organization of the material, right? It's just not a stream of consciousness, which some people like to read, right? Emails like that. It's not. It has to be organized. And again, you have to think about the reader and make it easy for the reader to understand what's going on. And spreadsheets also become a crutch, right? Which is, well, all the details are there. I'll just send you all the details and you can organize it in your own mind however you want to, which is a really lazy way of doing it. And so spreadsheets become a crutch for not having to think about the data, what it suggests, what conclusions ought to be drawn, what conclusion ought not to be drawn, and structuring it for the reader. So if I get a short email with an attachment, I almost instinctively believe that the person has just taken a tremendous shortcut and have taken the burden of all that intellectual work and stuck it on my shoulders. And I generally don't appreciate that.
They get a little black mark. The other thing about I've found about spreadsheets is that the way you think and the way you organize data on a spreadsheet is not the same as other people would. Mark and I were working on something together and I had changed it from horizontal to vertical because it fitted better, in my opinion. And he said, you can't do that. Time always moves left to right. It can't move up and down. And I was like, yeah, sure it can. It moves from the top to the bottom. Yeah, in my mind, yeah, of course it can.
Of course it can, right.
But his mind doesn't organize things like that. And so we were working on that spreadsheet for a reason together. But had I just been sending it to him, I wouldn't send him a spreadsheet. I'd try and find the data and make sure he had that without looking at the spreadsheet. Because if he looks at the spreadsheet, he's going to spend another 10 minutes working out how I've arranged it and why time isn't moving left to right. Because that's not what the way my brain works and the way his brain works are completely different. And I know that because I've worked with him for a long time, but you might not know that. Or know that as well about colleagues or your boss or people you are just working with for the first time.
Yeah, it's so funny how little things like that can trip up communications, right? It seems like, you know, whether I have, you know, what is now the vertical axis going up and down or the horizontal axis, if I switch those, I mean, the data is the same, right? The relationships are the same, right? It's a relationship between a value on the x-axis and the y-axis. If I switch them around, the relationship is the same. But it's amazing how, if you organize it incorrectly, how it just throw a whole, just a monkey wrench into the whole works. I always find it amazing. And often I'm getting spreadsheets or whatever. I have to spend a lot of time getting in the mind of the person who sent it to me to really have a framework for understanding what's being shared with me. And that, again, that can be very time consuming in terms of intellectual time and energy. And of course, if you do all this stuff, then you send all these spreadsheets around, it, you know, it takes up a lot of email, hard disk space, et cetera. So.
And space is, you know, cheap now. Every time you see something, it says server space is cheap. But when I've worked in organizations, we've always had a limit on how much data we can have on it in our email. And I've always hit it pretty quickly.
In most organizations, they have internally or they're using some external service for sharing of files, like Dropbox, for example, which we use, and manage tools we use quite a bit. And we don't have to send around spreadsheets, right? We can have a folder, it's organized, and you send a link to wherever that folder is, and people have access to it, so we don't have to send it around. And it avoids the versioning problem that you described, which is Mark's looking at version 1 from a week ago, and I'm looking at version 2 from a day ago, and we're having an argument about what the data says, only to realize later on that we're looking at two different spreadsheets, which is
so frustrating.
Yes. Oh my God.
And that's the end of our recommendations. So I'll summarize them. So the first one was use better subject lines. The second one was bottom line up front, then don't have scroll bars, keep your emails short, and don't use attachments, or try not to use attachments.
Yeah. And look at folks, it takes discipline to write good emails. It doesn't come naturally to all of us. It doesn't come naturally to me. But if you want to get the response that you need, You need to put the time and the effort to think about it and to write good emails. If you can get your percentage of good emails and responses up just a few percentage points, I mean, think just like 5% or 10%, that is time you're going to get back to spend on other more important things. So refine your skills, practice makes perfect, you know, and see what kind of results you get. I suspect for most people here, you spend a month focused on writing better emails, you will see results very, very quickly. And you'll never go back. Once you do it, you'll never go back to the old way.
The great thing is all these people that say, I get 400 emails a day, I get 800 emails a day, I send 700 emails a day. Well, that'd be great. There's 700 chances to practice a day.
There you go. So big inbox is an opportunity. I love it. There's some half full, glass half full thinking. So like it. Thanks, Wendy. Appreciate it.
Thanks. Bye, everyone.
Thanks, everyone. That's it for this week. We'll see you next week. Have a great one.
Career Tools produces actionable guidance for professionals every week. To receive additional materials via our newsletter and to find products for situations you may face, go to www.managertools.com. Search for Career Tools on Twitter and LinkedIn.